Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR News Station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Coming up on the program today, filmmaker Andrew Hevia tells us about his new documentary, Rising Tide, A Story of Miami Artists. Concert pianist, educator, and producer Dr. Paul Posnack shares his excitement about a new season of events coming from the St. Martha Yamaha Concert Series. Contributor Christy Angelis takes a look at the 100th anniversary of a treasured Miami watering hole. Now we feature our classical arts contributor Charles Greenfield in conversation with Justin Moss as they preview a new exciting season of offerings from the Florida Grand Opera.
The Florida Grand Opera celebrates its 72nd season in their home of over 5 years at the Arts Center's Ziff Ballet Opera House and the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. While its ambitious and costly program in 2006-2007 consisted of 6 productions, this season's production schedule for Dade and Broward audiences finds a comfortable schedule of 4 productions. In terms of management, the Florida Grand Opera has made a major leadership change with the retirement of longtime general director and CEO Robert Ewer for its new general director and CEO, Susan T. Danis. An arts administrator for 20 years, Danis has most recently served as executive director of the Sarasota Opera for the past 14 years. The main topic for the 2012-13 season is popular classical opera. Starting November 17th through December 8th, Puccini's immensely popular La Bohème brings the world of artists in Paris to the stage with memorable arias and heart-wrenching passion. January 28th to February 23rd, Mozart's The Magic Flute has glittering fairy tale characters with broad humor and girded by musical wit and pathos. February 9th through the 17th, Bellini's La Sonnambula, or The Sleepwalker, highlights the bel canto tradition, and April 20th to May 5th, Verdi's La Traviata tells the tale of the courtesan Violetta and her tragic dilemma for the love of Alfredo. To assess the changes in management and make more sense of the upcoming productions, I recently spoke to the Florida Grand Opera Director of Broward Operations, Justin Moss. Justin Moss, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat.
It's good to be back, Charles.
Justin, let's start off with some big administrative details. Robert Ewer, your CEO and General Director for 27 years, retired this May, and the new CEO and General Director is Susan T. Danis. Tell us about the transition and a little on Miss Danis and her previous career.
Well, this is her 5th week, and we think that's a real good sign that she stayed around for her second month and is really immersing herself very quickly. All of us on the staff, and I think all of the board members as well, feel that Susan Danis was exactly the right choice for Florida Grand Opera at this time, in this environment, and historically in this piece of the evolution of the company. This will be our 72nd season that we're opening in November of this year, and that's a long history. It's one of the oldest histories of any performing arts organization in all of the state of Florida. Susan served for several years as the general director of the Lake George Opera Festival, a very fine company in upstate New York, and then has for the past 13 years served as the head of Sarasota Opera, a wonderful company that's been cycling through every single opera written by Giuseppe Verdi over the last many, many years. She was there 13 years. This would have been her 14th. She has had some really significant accomplishments. Over her 13 years there, the budget grew from about $3.5 to $8.5 million. And more remarkable yet is the fact that she raised $20 million for a big renovation project of the theater in which they performed. the money was all raised, and the renovations have all been done. It's made a big difference for them, too.
Well, there's certainly a wow factor in that. As a spokesperson for the Florida Grand Opera, what are mission goals for Miss Danis in terms of programming and the artistic side of the opera?
I think the first thing she wants to do is try to move the company to a slightly more stable financial position, because that gives you a lot of leeway for artistic initiatives that you'd want to undertake. I know that she's committed to seeing the company produce more contemporary operas, operas from the 21st century and the 20th century. There's a wealth of unexplored material out there, or very infrequently seen material, that is underrepresented and really a great stretching opportunity for our audiences to hear. I think she's been in contact with a lot of really important singers who are anxious to come and sing for us here. And I think she also has an eye on co-productions with leading companies because of the economy, the price of gasoline, about which most of us are aware these days. It's actually cheaper to bring scenery from Europe than to drag it all the way across the country. And in this environment, it makes sense for us to explore co-producing with some of the European companies, Bastille, Covent Garden, and so forth. I think we'll see some of that. And she also would like to have at least once each season a production that employs cutting-edge stage technology, if you will, a production that will be visually absolutely stunning, very, very exciting, and full of new things that audiences simply haven't seen before.
Well, I know that the Met has a ring cycle monster for rent, if you want to use that.
And I think the only stage in the country that might be able to accommodate that would be the Arts Center, with a few little additional wings built out on the side.
Well, let's talk briefly about outreach to the community, students, and the Young Artists Studio Program.
We're continuing to bring about 1,000 high school students to every final dress rehearsal that we give. We find them one of our most enthusiastic audiences, and they get it. They get comfortable with the performances, with the whole drill of what it means to go to the opera. And then we're seeing when they're out working and making choices about their entertainment, they will come to the opera because they've done it, they're comfortable with it, they liked it, they found it rewarding, and they come back. We think that's one of the most valuable things that we can do here in the community. Our Young Artist Studio, it's been operating for about 30 years now, continues to improve. The level of the singers coming to that program just get better and better. And we are bringing back a couple of young artists, several, in fact, this coming season, who've gone through our Young Artist Studio and gone on to have big careers at the Metropolitan Opera, at La Scala. And we're so proud of them, and it's really wonderful for us to be able to have them back.
Now, the season begins November 17th with Puccini's La Bohème. How do you describe this beloved opera to those listeners who are not familiar with repertoire? It's a top five classical opera. What does this particular production bring to the stage that would lift it out of that sort of typical Parisian bohemian cafe garret grand gesture set?
Well, you know, what I think I should say is that for all those people who are sitting out there listening to this program, and I know you're out there, who are thinking, you know, I've always wanted to go to the opera, but I never really could quite get up the nerve to, you know, go through the drill because I'm uncomfortable, I don't know how to behave or what to expect, this is the one to start with. La Bohème is probably one of the most accessible and immensely rewarding pieces of musical theater ever created. A heartbreaking story, beautiful, gorgeous music, some of the most famous arias ever composed. And we have wonderful, young, attractive artists who are singing in this production. Eileen Perez, who is singing Mimi, is this year's Richard Tucker Prize winner, which is the operatic equivalent of the Heisman Trophy, if you will, joined by Arturo Chacon Cruz, who has sung with us before and comes back. He just had a huge success at San Francisco Opera, singing The Duke in Rigoletto. Artists that are visually believable, dramatically compelling, and musically just spectacular.
Let's discuss Mozart's The Magic Flute. It starts January 26. In Berlin about a decade ago, I went to a wonderful and playful production where the audience was filled with German school kids and their parents. Laughter and sheer delight ruled that lovely matinee. What can we expect with your production?
Well, I think you can expect a real treat with our production. It's coming from a New York City opera. It has a radical design. It's a lot of fun. and a team of wonderful artists who will be performing these roles. This was a huge success, you know, when Mozart first presented this work to the public. It took them by surprise, actually. They had to add numerous performances that they hadn't scheduled initially. And it was maybe not the most fashionable theater in Vienna, but everyone just flocked to it because it was so incredibly enjoyable as a piece of entertainment and a glorious piece of musical composition.
Bellini's La Sonnambula starts February 9th. This is an opera that's not played that often, or is it? Tell us about it.
It's not played that often, and it's really too bad that it's not. Bellini is one of the grand masters of the bel canto, or beautiful singing style. Joan Sutherland, Renata Scotto, Beverly Sills, all were famous in the role of Amina in La Sonnambula. It means the sleepwalker. It's a story about a young girl who gets herself into trouble on her nocturnal carousing and is accused of infidelity, and it's only when the whole village is gathered and sees her sleepwalking into a very dangerous situation that they realize she is, in fact, innocent of all the charges that had been leveled against her. Glorious, glorious music, a real showpiece for a spectacular soprano. And Rachel Gilmore, a former member of our Young Artist Studio, who had a huge success with her Metropolitan Opera debut as Olympia in The Tales of Hoffman, is returning to sing in this production, which will be directed by Renata Scotto, who herself was one of the most famous Aminas of our time.
Now, I've always enjoyed the sheer musicality of Verdi's La Traviata. Your production comes to the stage April 20th. I imagine we will be seduced by the stagecraft, the costumes, and of course, the singing.
This is a production that we own, which we first produced a number of seasons ago. It's a beautiful, realistic period production that just communicates the whole feel of the epic, the feel of the time. Beautiful women supported by the wealthiest men in Paris in grand style, giving terrific balls. And, of course, the heartbreaking story of this young girl who'd arrived in Paris at about the age of 16 and doesn't live beyond the age of about 22 or 23. It, again, is a perfect first opera for somebody who's sitting out there on the fence and considering the opera but hasn't done it yet. My advice is come and see La Boheme, and then you will run, not walk, to return and see La Traviata.
Well, thank you, Justin, for being on South Florida Arts Beat.
Charles, it's always my pleasure. Thank you for having me back.
Despite the reduction from 6 to 4 productions in recent years, the Florida Grand Opera seems determined to manage their way in a conservative and sensible fashion to survive both regional and national tougher times. Years of solid and successful productions are its trademark, and it's not hard to imagine that the Florida Grand Opera will continue its quest to remain one of the country's leading opera companies. For information on tickets and scheduling, contact 1-800-741-1010 or go to their website at fgo.org. For South Florida Arts Beat, I'm Charles Greenfield.
Charles Greenfield has written for the Miami Herald and the Coral Gables Gazette and is a current contributor to famtripper.com. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will continue in just a moment. Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the show, contributor Chris DeAngelis runs down the history of Miami's oldest watering hole, known for its musical presentations over the last 30 years. Now, our classical arts contributor, Charles Greenfield, previews a new season of excitement coming to the St. Martha Yamaha Concert Series.
Once one of South Florida's best-kept secrets, the St. Martha Yamaha Concert Series at the Church of St. Martha in Miami Shores brings noted musical artists to the region. Directed by Professor Paul Posnack, noted pianist and transcriber of George Gershwin and Fats Waller, with 14 CDs on various labels including EMI and Naxos, Posnack is professor of keyboard performance and director of the Collaborative Piano Program at the University of Miami Frost School of Music. A child prodigy, he received bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees from the Juilliard School of Music, culminating in the Loeb Prize, the highest award at America's premier music school. Working with Father Federico Captipon at St. Martha Church on Biscayne Boulevard and 93rd Street, Posnack has organized excellent concerts in the 450-seat Oak Roof Sanctuary with its Yamaha C7 Conservatory Grand Piano. Posnack has recorded with stellar groups like the Emerson String Quartet and the Dorian Woodwind Quintet. He soloed with the National Symphony Orchestra at the Kennedy Center and even gave a special concert for the U.S. Supreme Court in May 2003. Recently, I had the pleasure to talk to Paul Posnack about the St. Martha Yamaha 2012-13 concert series. Paul Posnack, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat.
Great to be here with you, Charles.
Let's talk a little bit about your relationship with the Miami-Dade Public Schools, artist visits with students, and the Parent Academy. I hear that Superintendent Carvalho is a frequent attendee of the St. Martha series.
Oh, yeah, he's become a fan, and we have a wonderful relationship with him and with the school system. And all our artist ensembles are required as part of the contract to do a good hour and a half session, which sometimes tends to go longer with students in the schools. It's just great performing and interacting, and they play for us. We visit with them, we talk, and the feedback has been wonderful from the artists and ensembles, as well as from the students
now,
and teachers.
Funding is always a challenge. Why don't you briefly describe that process?
Well, we have a wonderful board, Julie and Bob Williamson, and a wonderful group of volunteers that set this up. We get funding from, of course, the city of Miami Shores, where we're located, but also from a variety of foundations, state funding. But a lot of our support comes from individual contributors who have fallen in love with this series, with the ambiance, with the artists and ensembles that we bring in, and the whole community orientation of the program, which is very, very low ticket prices. So families and people with any economic, socioeconomic background can come and enjoy.
Could you briefly tell us about the sound actually that's produced within the hall?
It's like a great concert hall. It's the best, I think, acoustic, well, almost all the groups that come think it's the best acoustic property in all of South Florida. It's all tongue and groove oak, and you can hear beautifully with resonance, clarity, and warmth from any seat in the house, and it seats over 650.
Now, you start your series Sunday, November 11th at 3 p.m. with The Red Priest.
Uh-huh.
If you are a music detective, you would know immediately that refers to music's big redhead, Antonio Vivaldi. This colorfully named quartet has superstar recorder player Piers Adam and England's The Red Priest. Give us a scoop on this group.
Well, they're one of the single handful of great Renaissance and Baroque ensembles in the world. And it's not just their playing. It's like a theater event with masks and costumes and stage interaction. Their playing is extraordinarily alive. The entire second half is devoted to the four seasons of Vivaldi, but no one plays it like this group does.
On Saturday, December 15th at 7:30 p.m., composer, pianist, Pulitzer Prize winner William Balcom and his wife soprano Joan Morris team up for classics, holiday songs, and Balcom's own works. Sounds like an intimate evening.
Yeah. Well, as many people know, William Balcom is one of our national treasures. I've been playing his rags forever, and his operas have been performed all over the world. His Songs of Innocence and Experience won the Pulitzer. He's a great accompanist, and his wife, Joan Morris, she is one of the great song stylists of all time, and they do a history of popular song from the parlor songs until the present, including his own wonderful cabaret songs, and that's something not to be missed. They're an extraordinary and unique duo.
And you follow that Sunday, January 27th, next year at 3 p.m., with the husband-wife team, conductor-pianist-magician Klaus Donath and opera diva Helen Donath. They're doing their own form of enchantment. What's going on with them?
Yeah, we have this duo of duos, and she is, of course, Helen Donath, for those who don't know, is one of the great opera singers of all time. And her husband, Klaus, is a well-known conductor. And their career in Europe especially has launched them into international fame. She's going to be doing a varied program, including Latin literature. She speaks fluent Spanish, of course, German, where they live, French, and is one of the great communicators as well as singers. And she's an international superstar, not to be missed. And Klaus may entertain the audience at intermission and maybe even between sets with a little of his magic show.
Magicianship. Sunday, March 17th at 3 p.m., you present the Chamber Orchestra Kremlin. Tell us about them.
This is one of the great virtuoso string orchestras in the world, really. And they're doing their North American tour, and they'll be on our series. And I'm going to play the Rhapsody in Blue with them in a chamber orchestra version.
And then you close the season April 27th at 7:30 p.m. with Cuban-born pianist Juana Zaya in Schumann, Ginastera, and Lecuona. And you join Miss Zaya in Gershwin's Cuban Overture. That's going to be an explosive evening.
Juana Zaya is one of our great Cuban-American pianists of such great stature. She's become famous for her the entire Chopin etudes and her Schumann playing. And she almost stopped her career, or certainly curtailed it, when she had her three children, and then she came back and wowed the world. And that's going to be a wonderful ending. I should just mention one other thing. We have a special concert on April 6th that Shelley Berg, our dean at the UM School of Music, is bringing Tierney Sutton and Carmen Bradford, two of the legendary singers of our own time, to do a very special program of jazz standards. And this was going to be a benefit concert for the St. Martha Yamaha series. It's going to be a very special event, and it's going to include Shelley Berg's Conversions, which is a piece he wrote for the Dalai Lama, and also a new work especially composed for the occasion. It's going to be a very special event. I should also mention that at all our concerts, you know, we go into the big atrium, closed atrium of the church, and after the concert, the audience meets and mingles with the artists and eats wonderful food prepared by part of the community of the church, and wine and soft drinks and nuts and cheeses, and it's a real community event.
Well, it sounds like an acoustic buffet, certainly, Paul, and I want to thank you for attending South Florida Arts Beat.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
The St. Martha Yamaha Concert Series and founding artistic director Paul Posnack are hardly secrets anymore, and for good cause, since their programming and extremely reasonable ticket prices make them one of the best deals in town. Additionally, their sanctuary setting and atrium reception space make for an ideal weekend musical treat with extensive free parking and easy access on Biscayne Boulevard and 93rd Street in Miami Shores. To purchase tickets, call 1-800-595-4849 or click on their website, stmartha.tix.com. You can also get tickets at the church office or at the door. For South Florida Arts Beat, I'm Charles Greenfield.
Charles Greenfield has written for the Miami Herald and the Coral Gables Gazette and is a current contributor to famtripper.com. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will continue in just a moment. And welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. Hello, Ed Bell with you. WLRN-TV Channel 17 premieres a new WLRN original production of a documentary next Wednesday, the 14th at 8 p.m. It's called Rising Tide, A Story of Miami Artists. And it features seven talented young local Miami visual artists and their place in our area's exploding arts environment. And with us today is the documentary's producer, director, editor, fundraiser, Andrew Hevia. And welcome to the South Florida Arts Beat Show, Andrew. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
Yeah. Tell us, today is the is it hard to make a documentary?
That's a big question.
Was it hard for you? You're a new filmmaker. You've had a lot of schooling coming out of the New World School of the Arts, which is magnificent, and a stint in California, the film market there. But how long did you work on this, and what did you encounter?
This movie, it's actually been in the process for over 2 years.
2 years.
And grew out of my work here at the station when I used to work here as an editor and segment producer.
Mm-hmm.
We had a show, or I worked on a show called Art Street, which is on WLRN, and we focused on the Miami art scene. So it's something that I've sort of been immersed in actually since I went to high school here at New World with the visual art program and meeting a lot of the artists back when, you know, a decade ago. Then this project came about with the Knight Foundation Knight Art Challenge Grant,
mm-hmm.
Which was something I applied for, won, and spent basically a year in the fundraising process. Which
for your first production.
Right, for the first feature-length documentary that I have produced and directed. Because I've worked on other films before, but this was definitely the first movie that I can say this was mine.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of great people made it possible. A lot of great people worked on it. A lot of people are responsible for this movie beyond me. But I had more to do with this than I've had to do with anything else.
Mm-hmm. So was it cumbersome? Was it – it was all a learning experience. Was it
was
awkward?
Was it
great fun?
I would describe it as a learning experience, yes and no. Like the film part I'm pretty confident with and know how to do. I've been doing that for years. Not only did I go to school for it, it's been – 6 or 7 years since I graduated that I've been able to work and be constantly working on things. The learning process for me was the fundraising process, was the stuff around the movie. This, doing radio. I've never done a live radio show to promote a piece I've done. This is sort of the new world.
Mm-hmm.
Making a movie people want to watch and get to watch is a great experience.
Now, you cover a number of great artists, 7 artists. Which artists are you featuring in Rising Tide, and why are they distinct in South Florida's prodigious art scene?
Well, so one of the things that I, growing up in Miami and being a young student, basically, when Art Basel Miami Beach first came to Miami, was sort of a watershed moment for me, because it was a moment where the arts, the international art community sort of brought some focus to Miami, and I was suddenly aware of all these great things happening in all these different cities and all these different places. I was aware that the world was much bigger than the one I had experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, was something I wanted to go into making the movie. So I focused on a set of artists that could either speak directly to the influence of Basel or came of age after Basel happened. So there have been great artists in Miami for a very long time, and there are many of them very established doing really great things. I wanted to focus on a certain cross-section of basically 20-somethings who were going through an experience similar to me, part of the reawakening of the city, recognizing that there are great things going on here and actively taking a part in it. There's actually something I'd read. I'd read in a book called 7 Days in the Art World, where they talk about the art cities that are separate from the major areas of the New Yorks, the Parises, the LAs, and it takes a conscious effort to stay in those cities because they're smaller scenes. And a lot of these artists are ones who very pointedly staked the flag and said, I'm from Miami, I'm in Miami, I'm going to work from Miami. So those are the ones that I really wanted to focus on.
And they were?
Well, so we start with Jen Stark, Vanessa Minokian, the TM sisters, who are mixed media performance artists, Tasha and Monica, who are actual sisters, a performance art duo. It's not really performance. An art experimental group called Funner Projects, which is Justin Long and Rob Meatball Laurie, and an artist named Brookhart Jonquil, who is the only non-native Miami artist we feature there. We also spent a lot of time with Brooke Dorsch, who's a gallery owner. He owns the Dorsch Gallery in Wynwood and was representing Brookhart throughout the event.
So obviously these are very distinct artists. That's why you chose them.
Part of the idea was that I wanted artists that one are a little different than what you expect when you think art. I've seen a lot of art documentaries. A lot of them are about painters.
Mm-hmm.
Painting is wonderful. Painting is not necessarily a cinematic form. It can be, but you have to do a lot of tricks. You know, put glass up and paint on glass so you can film the action of it. It's also what you kind of expect. And I think one of the things that's great about Miami is that there's a lot of really unexpected art. Artists like Brookhart, who are constructing mirror reflection sculptures that create fictional objects. You know, like he sets up 2 panes of glass and an object between them, and the glass is structured in such a way that single line becomes a square, mm-hmm. floating only in that visual space when you're looking at it from a certain angle. Or Funner Projects, who during the film had a performance piece up at the De La Cruz Collection in the Design District, which is a 14-foot mechanized crossbow that launches 2x4s 150 miles an hour at constructed targets. Like, this is their art piece, and they would every hour on the hour, three times, you know, every 20 minutes, they would launch one. They would have these costumes, and they would make an engaging, thrilling destruction, the art of destruction. And that's not something you think of when you think of art. You think art can be kind of boring and slow, and like, okay, yes, that's also there. It can also be a very personal, private experience, meditative. It can also be just a wild experience.
So you've covered a lot of artists moving beyond boundaries. Rising Tide, A Story of Miami Artists, premieres next week, Wednesday, November 14th at 8 p.m. on WLRN-TV, Channel 17. It re-airs Saturday, November 17th at 7 and Sunday, November 18th at 1 p.m. We'll take a brief break right now to do a little business and be back with our guest, Andrew Hevia of Rising Tide, A Story of Miami Artists. Stay with us.
It's South Florida Arts Beat on 91.3 WLRN. Good afternoon. The Bill Cosford Cinema at the University of Miami presents Nobody Walks. Called evocative by the Village Voice, the story follows a family's surge of emotions and desire brought to the surface by their house guest. Showtimes and more details at cosfordcinema.com.
The Pembroke Pines Theater presents the Broadway smash hit Annie. Performances are Friday and Saturday evenings at 8 and Saturday and Sunday matinees at 2. Tickets at 954-437-4884 or online at pptopa.com. That's pptopa.com.
And it's 1:49. Ed Bell with you here on South Florida Arts Beat. Our guest, Andrew Hevia, producer, editor, and director of the new documentary that premieres on WLRN-TV, Channel 17, next Wednesday at 8, Rising Tide, A Story of Miami Artists. So many questions to ask you about this. I wish we had more time, but you're a graduate of the New World School of the Arts, and tell us about your experience there. I find that an amazing school.
I absolutely loved my experience there. I was a student there 1999 to 2003. Studied visual art, went to school with a lot of very talented people, some of whom are actually in the movie. Jen Stark was an alum. Mm-hmm. She graduated a year ahead of me. And Tasha Lopez de Victoria of the TM Sisters, also a New World alum. I think New World is I think, doing incredible things. It's a great program and turns out a lot of talented people. Yeah, I mean, the visual artists who've gone there are really incredible.
So in your education, you expanded. You went out to California, of course, the mecca for film and whatnot.
After graduating college, I went to San Francisco, which is the more bohemian version of California. I definitely haven't gone to L.A. for any great length of time yet. But I went to San Francisco actually not for film at all. I went there for an independent publishing company mm-hmm. Called McSweeney's. Which is they do really great things in print, and had a short film DVD called Wolfen, which is what happens when a whale and a dolphin mate and creates a wolfen, a unique creative hybrid that is unlike anything you've seen before.
Well, your first offering, of course, Rising Tide, A Story of Miami Artists, covers these struggling artists. There must be 10,000 artists here in South Florida in our multi-county area. Struggling for an identity and to eke out a career, but thank goodness, you know, the tidal wave of Art Basel comes to us once a year, bringing fresh faces and hopefully fat wallets and people that can sustain these careers. But give us your opinion of the arts environment here in South Florida. Of course, it's exploded over the past number of years, and it continues to grow.
I think, well, one of the great things about Miami's art scene is that it is a fairly healthy art scene. Like it took me an hour to make this argument in the film, so it's hard for me to condense this into a couple of seconds. But the idea is that Miami's art ecosystem, which is something that I've started to see and sort of frame is about much more than the artist simply working. It's about the artist working. It's about the people in locally supporting it. It's about the shows that are happening. It's this all-encompassing view of an art culture. And Miami is doing incredible things with it. Even if you look at just actually last night, I was at an event with the National Young Arts Foundation.
Oh, you were there too.
Who just bought
Magnificent.
The, yeah. And the fact that, that Bacardi Building is becoming this campus for, mm-hmm. for a national art foundation is a really incredible thing and a sign of where Miami's headed.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't imagine a better marriage for that Bacardi space. Once they left the building, who better to give it to than Young Arts? So I feel like Miami is definitely on the up and up. There are incredible things going on here, and I really think it's a great place to be.
We've got artists coming out of New World School of the Arts, FIU, University of Miami, MDC. My gosh, is there room for them all here in South Florida?
Well, I think part of the – for the artists, sure. The art scene is still pretty intimate. But what it really comes down to, though, is having people outside of the actual artists who are supporting those artists,
yeah,
having people
infrastructure.
Who – right. And that's something Miami is growing and needs to grow more of. Hopefully the film is – ideally I made it as an idea that it's an accessible introduction to Miami's art scene for the people who aren't already in it. Mm. I find that a lot of art documentaries and a lot of people when they talk about art are very exclusive. It's very about – you have to be in the world to know who they're talking about, why they're talking about it, what's important. And what I wanted to do here was open that up to people who maybe haven't been introduced to it yet,
mm-hmm.
because that's actually the next step in Miami's process is expanding to the people who live in the city who don't know that there are great things going on here and you can be a part of it.
Sure, sure. What future topics might you cover, and are you going to stay in South Florida and keep giving us great documentaries?
Ideally, I will continue to make films in and about Miami for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Will I physically be here all the time? Probably less than I have been. But work takes you where work takes you.
Sure.
But I can't change the fact that you know, my storytelling heart is based in Miami.
Well, any topics in mind that you're thinking about already?
Well, there are a couple Miami-specific things, and there's a general. There are stories that I'd like to make. One, actually, I'd love to work with. There's a marine biologist art duo. Do you know Coral Morphologic?
No.
So they do incredible work. They're marine biologists who focus on South Florida's, you know, underwater life, but also do incredible art based on this stuff. And if you Google Coral Morphologic, you'll find some really astonishing videos. Mm. These guys are doing great work, and I would love to work with them on a long-form story about what's going on in Miami underwater.
So you're primarily interested in further documenting the South Florida art scene in all of its variety.
If I were to do a documentary about Miami art, mm-hmm. that would be the next step.
Mm-hmm.
I am also working on a project. I'm right now really interested in doing a character-based documentary, mm-hmm. One where you follow one person or two people through a particular event, more in that sense, more narrative, you know, less context, less summary of a situation and more – human story. And there's one I'm working on right now about a character, about a guy named Jerry Joseph, which is a fairly long, complicated story. It involves Texas and basketball in Miami and you know, potentially a false identity.
So we have about 30 seconds to talk about the Knight Foundation. Thankfully, they gave you a grant that got this whole thing started, and I'm sure it was a great association.
Yeah. This whole thing began with the Knight Arts Challenge Grant, which has been an incredible opportunity. Dennis Scholl, the Knight Foundation, everyone there, Tatiana, and I mean, everyone I've worked with the Knight Foundation has been stellar and supported every project with gusto and you know, generosity.
Bravo to you and bravo to the Knight Foundation. Once again, Rising Tide, a story of Miami artists, premiering on WLRN TV Channel 17 this coming Wednesday, November 14th at 8 p.m., rebroadcast on Saturday, November 17th and Sunday, November 18th. Thank you so much for joining us, Andrew Hevia.
My pleasure. Thanks, Ryan.
Good luck. Should you be interested in helping out the American Red Cross Hurricane Sandy Relief Fund, you can find more information at redcross.org. Now, we were to have featured Chris DeAngelis's wonderful piece on the 100th anniversary of Tobacco Road, a great legendary watering hole here in South Florida. We will be putting that on our website this afternoon at WLRN.org. We certainly hope you go there and listen to that. It's a wonderful piece. And what a great little legend of South Florida. We'll rebroadcast South Florida Arts Beat tonight and every Friday night at 7 p.m. on our WLRN Extra HD channel. You can tune in on your HD radio or go to our website at WLRN.org for more information. And that's today's edition of South Florida Arts Beat. We hope you enjoyed the show. Adrian Kennedy is our executive producer. I'm Ed Bell, producer and host. Our theme was composed by Mike Levine and performed by Mike and Sam Levine. Special thanks to our technical director today, Andy Wagner. We'd also like to thank our contributors, Charles Greenfield and Chris DeAngelis. Please call us with your comments at 305-995-2258. You can fax us at 305-995-2221 or email us at info@WLRN.org. We'd like to hear from you. Monday at this time, of course, Topical Currents with host Joseph Cooper, Monday at 1 o'clock. Have yourself a great weekend, and please, as always, keep your dial set right here to 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Until next time, this is Ed Bell saying bye-bye. Enjoy.